The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro, Part 3. Continued on cassette number 5, side 1. D.F. Strickland of Mission, Texas, a powerful Austin lobbyist and an oilman, sent Johnson a money order for $1,000, also with a message. I am particularly interested in re-electing a Democratic House so that my friends Lyndon Johnson, Sam Rayburn, Hatton Sumners, Milton West, and other Texas congressmen may retain their present positions of honor and influence in the House. C.W. Murchison, First National Bank Building, Dallas, sent $5,000. Toddy L. Wynn, First National Bank Building, Dallas, sent $5,000. If the pipeline for political oil money from Texas had been opened 2 weeks before, Monday, October 28, 1940, was the date the flow was stepped up. How much money gushed up from Dallas on that date cannot be determined, because some never passed through the Congressional Campaign Committee, but was distributed at Johnson's instructions by others. But on Tuesday, October 29th, 1 week before the election, the anxious congressman received a telegram from Lyndon Johnson. "Am attempting to get additional help for Congressional Committee in order that we can give you more financial assistance. If very urgent, wire me today, absolute minimum and deadline." A week to go, less than a week, there was desperation in those yellow envelopes now. "There is no absolute minimum," George B. Kelly of Rochester wired. "Anything will help the fight against odds. Very urgent." Snatching the envelopes from the messengers, Henderson or Connolly would read, "We need funds and need them badly. Imperative. Any amount." Or, "We are $600 behind now with more expense to come. Absolute minimum necessary, $350. Or, "Approximately 10,000 majority for Wilkie in my district. More money needed." Or, "Lyndon urgently need at least $500 by Saturday. Would estimate 15,000 majority for national ticket if opposition money does not increase over weekend." Or, "Lyndon, situation in danger here. Really believe district may be in trouble due to heavy Republican expenditures. Any sum would be much appreciated. Could use $1,000. Prospects and majority uncertain." Some telegraphed repeatedly. Two wires arrived from the new congressman from Washington's 2nd District. Henry M. Scoop Jackson, elected just a few months before in a special election, saw danger that his career would be over almost before it had begun. "Slight shift my district to Republicans. This will be crucial week. My election will be close. Have received no assistance from Democratic National Committee. Please wire $1,000. When he did not receive an immediate reply, Jackson wired again. "Absolute minimum, $750 necessary immediately. My race extremely close. Am only new congressman in state. Need funds now. Personal credit exhausted. Wire answer." Petrie's 11,000 pieces of mail had been set in type, but the $350 which would enable him to mail them, the $350 for which he had asked Johnson, had not arrived. He sent another telegram, anxiously awaiting reply. Some of his fellow congressmen were trying frantically to get Lyndon Johnson on the telephone. J. Buell Snyder spoke to one of his secretaries, and her report of his message was to the point. "In trouble, needs help." Leonard E. Bauer of Indiana sent a wire at 1:37 p.m. on October 30th. "Please contact me on telephone earliest possible moment. Must talk to you." When, 4 hours later, he had not heard from Johnson, he sent another telegram. "Need $400. Still must talk to you." In far-off Washington State, Martin Smith had been running hard, but time for him to make up the ground he had lost because of Congress's late recess was running out, and he feared he was still behind. Lewis County was his district's most rock-bed Republican territory, but picking up votes there was his best hope. On the 28th, Smith left for Lewis with a bullhorn. During the next 3 days, he was planning to address rallies and speak informally in the county's little towns. But Smith was afraid that, run as hard as he could, he would not be able to reach enough voters with a bullhorn to pull this race out. He could reach more by radio, and had reserved radio time on all 5 stations in his district. But FCC regulations required that radio time be paid for in advance. He had reserved space for last-minute ads in the district's daily newspapers, but they had to be paid for, too. Johnson had done so much for him, but what he had done wasn't enough. Leaving for Lewis County, Smith wired him, "Imperative, every effort be made to further assist me." Then on the 29th, Johnson's telegram arrived at his headquarters in Hoquiam. Tracking the congressman down by telephone, his secretary, Robert A. LaRue, read him Johnson's telegram, and Smith told LaRue to reply, "Minimum should be 500 and deadline Saturday." And the secretary added a sentence showing how hard his boss was fighting and how much he needed Johnson's help. "Have just succeeded in contacting Congressman Smith by long distance at Onalaska, Lewis County, where he's holding mass meeting with loudspeaker, one of 12 meetings today in this strong Republican county." Henderson and Connolly summarized, state by state, each candidate who replied, the amount he needed, and any additional information he furnished. Lyndon Johnson sat down with this list, and in the left-hand margin wrote the amount each man was to receive. He wasn't wasting his money. A candidate's assessment of his chances was discreetly checked and rechecked through other sources. Evaluations of the races in Illinois' 25 districts, for example, were telephoned to Johnson by the dean of the state's congressional delegation, Adolph J. Sabbath, chairman of the House Rules Committee. If a report said that the candidate had a good chance to win, the candidate got his money. Assistant Secretary of Agriculture Grover Hill, on a speech-making tour through rural districts, reported from Kansas's 5th that, although the race was close, Democrat incumbent John M. Houston has good chance to win. Houston had responded to Johnson's telegram by asking for $300. That was what he got. But if a report was highly unfavorable, so was Johnson's response. Noel P. Fox, Democratic candidate in Michigan's 9th district, told Johnson that he was leading by 1,500 votes, but Johnson knew better. Fox, in fact, was to lose by 12,000. "None," he wrote next to Fox's name. Other considerations might also influence Johnson's response. Montana incumbent James F. O'Connor, who was running well ahead in his district, had apparently antagonized someone in Washington. Johnson had promised him a contribution on the 24th, but had not sent it, and now O'Connor asked for $300. "Opposition using a lot of money to elect Republican in my place," he said. "If have help, sure can win." "None," Johnson wrote next to O'Connor's name. "Out." Many of the candidates who responded received less than they had requested. Thomas R. Brooks telephoned the Muncie building, telling one of Johnson's staff that he had a slight edge, and said a scheduled election eve visit to his heavily Norwegian district in Wisconsin by the ambassador to Norway might pull him through, if he received money as well. He asked for $2,000, then lowered his request to $1,000, and as the staffer noted, finally came down to $500. Then he sent a wire, "Whatever you can do." $250, Johnson wrote next to his name. C. Arthur Anderson, who said he is in the midst of a tough fight, had asked for $350. Receiving no immediate answer, he telephoned Johnson and reduced his request to $200. $150, Johnson wrote beside his name. Others did not fare that well. Francis D. Murphy said he had a 50-50 chance. He could win, he said, by getting vote to polls in key wards, but money was needed to accomplish that. "None," Johnson wrote next to Murphy's name. C. H. Armbruster of Ohio asked for $1,000, but said he would take less. "Urgent," he said. "None," Johnson wrote. $1,000 would be a lifesaver," George W. Wolfe wrote. "Two counties hold fate. Hard battle." "None." Johnson's decision to cut off some candidates was not due to lack of funds. Most of the candidates who replied received at least a substantial portion of the amount they had requested. Scoop Jackson got $500 of the $750 he had requested, George B. Kelly $350 of the $400 for which he had asked. Some got all they had asked for. Rogers had asked for $500. "Okay," Johnson wrote next to his name, $500. Mitchell got his $600, Lee Geyer the $200 which enabled him to pay the printer. Some got more than they had requested. Myers of Pennsylvania $700 instead of the $500 for which he had asked, for example. Havener of California $1,250. And in other instances, Johnson did not wait for a candidate's request, but pressed funds upon him. J. Joseph Smith of Connecticut received a Johnson check, and the next day, November 2nd, a Johnson telegram. If I can be of further help to you in the last-minute rush, let me know. Some, in fact, were given so much money that they asked Johnson to stop sending it. Michael Kirwan, who had told John McCormick on October 18th that he was hard-pressed for money, had since received so much from Johnson, $200 on October 17th, $500 on October 21st, $350 more on October 24th, and these, of course, are only the contributions of which there is a written record, that he replied to Johnson's telegram of the 29th by thanking him for your offer of further assistance, but adding, however, I believe I have sufficient to see me through. Charles H. Levy of Washington had written on his questionnaire that he didn't need money. Think I will be able to handle situation without outside help, he had said. Johnson had sent him $600 nonetheless. Now Johnson asked him how much more he needed, and Levy replied by sending him a gift, a box of State of Washington apples. Election Day, the day on which information, early information, was most precious because a candidate, his fate riding on the ballots, is impatient for an early indication of a trend. Because if he learns early enough that the vote is close, a last-minute effort to get out his voters can be mounted or intensified. And because, in states in which some portion of the vote is controlled, Illinois, with its controlled Republican votes in downstate counties and its controlled Democratic votes in Cook County, was a prime example, early information is helpful in preparing for the necessary late adjustment in the figures. Washington's new source of information had geared up for Election Day, sending out on October 29th his request for information on their finances to 175 congressmen across the country. Lyndon Johnson had added a request for other information, early returns not only on their own races, but on Franklin D. Roosevelt's, and, if you do everything, had followed that up in later telegrams, including one on the day itself. He had let the White House know he would have information for it. Roe already knew, of course, but as Roe himself puts it, Johnson never did anything through just one person. He was not well acquainted with Missy LeHand, and this was an excuse to communicate with her. He wired her that, if I feel the information is of sufficient interest, I will take the liberty to call the president. For that reason, I am letting you know in advance of my plan. The information for which he had asked arrived, early as he had asked. By 2:47 p.m. on Election Day, the first flash was in from Detroit. Michigan first district voting heavy indicates bettering previous Democratic majority, Tenorovitz reported. By late afternoon, Western Union messengers were racing to the third floor of the Muncie building in a steady stream. Other news came over the telephone. James Shanley of Connecticut telephoned at 6:45 because, as he was to write, I certainly wanted to give you the first news in Washington. In the evening, the telegrams bore hard news. The first telegrams from other Detroit districts were less optimistic than Tenorovitz's. The figures in the initial communication from Representative George D. O'Brien were close, too close. 104 precincts out of 222, O'Brien 28,700, McLeod 24,769. But just 24 minutes later, O'Brien could dictate another wire. 140 districts out of 222, O'Brien 39,797, McLeod 28,586. Some of the telegrams were tinged with jubilation as well as gratitude. Edward Isaac's last pre-election wire had told Johnson, Roosevelt should win by 10,000, my prospects doubtful. But on election night, the wire from California said, apparently winning by approximately 8,000, thanks. Some were not. John G. Green, who had thought up to the last minute that he might beat out incumbent Republican Bernard J. Gehrman, wired, Gehrman apparently reelected. Damn tired. At 2:37 a.m., a single brief line arrived from Ernest M. Miller in Harlan, Iowa. Present partial returns indicate my decisive defeat. Jubilant or dejected, however, the telegrams taken together added up to a great deal of information. On the evening of Election Day, Johnson wasn't at the Muncie building, but at the spacious Georgetown home of Jim Rowe's brother-in-law, Alfred Friendly, where a crowded election night party was in progress. His staff, back at the Muncie building, was taking the reports as they came in and telephoning them to Johnson there. Many more reports came in than Johnson had expected so early in the evening, and he telephoned Walter Jenkins and told him to come out to Friendly's house. Jenkins was installed in a bedroom where he sat on the bed tabulating the incoming information. Johnson and Rowe bantered back and forth throughout the evening in the easy and then quite close camaraderie that existed between them. They had several wagers, 25 cents each, as befitted two young men with no money to spare, riding on the returns. Rowe, reflecting the prevalent Washington thinking on the likely outcome of the congressional elections, had bet that the Democrats would lose at least 30 seats in the House. Johnson had bet that the Democrats would lose less than 30. And the two tall young men, both in their early 30s, also bet on several individual races, while they waited for a call from Hyde Park. For some hours, no call came. In the house above the Hudson, crowded with family and friends, the president sat at the dining room table, with news tickers clattering nearby and big tally sheets, and a row of freshly sharpened pencils lined up in front of him. At first, as Burns has written in an unforgettable scene, the president was calm and businesslike. The early returns were mixed. Morgenthau, nervous and fussy, bustled in and out of the room. Suddenly, Mike Riley, the president's bodyguard, noticed that Roosevelt had broken into a heavy sweat. Something in the returns had upset him. It was the first time Riley had ever seen him lose his nerve. "Mike," Roosevelt said suddenly, "I don't want to see anybody in here." "Including your family, Mr. President?" "I said anybody," Roosevelt answered in a grim tone. As the news tickers clattered feverishly, Franklin Roosevelt sat before his charts with his jacket off, his tie pulled down, his shirt clinging damply to his big shoulders. "Was this the end of it all?" Burns writes. "Better by far not to have run for office again than to go down to defeat now." Would his enemies beat him at last? And write his epitaph in history as a power-grasping dictator rebuked by a free people? In the little black numbers marching out of the ticker, not only Roosevelt, but the whole New Deal was on trial. Still, Wilkie ran strong. Disappointing first returns were coming in from New York. The ash dropped from the cigarette. Mike Riley stood stolidly outside the door. Was this the end? Then there was a stir throughout the house. Slowly, but with gathering force, the numbers on the charts started to shift their direction. Reports arrived of a great surge of Roosevelt's strength. By now Roosevelt was smiling again, the door was open, and in came family and friends. And the president made a number of telephone calls, including one to Jim Rowe and Lyndon Johnson. The 22-year-old Jenkins had been thrilled by other calls he had been taking. "It was the most exciting night of my life," he would recall. "I thought I was in the high cotton, all those big shots, you know." Voices on the telephone that had previously been only names in a newspaper. And then the call from the biggest name of all. "Mr. Roosevelt called and asked how many seats we were going to lose, and Mr. Johnson said, 'We're not going to lose, we're going to gain.'" He and Rowe got on extensions and talked to the president. Recalls Rowe, "Johnson got good early counts, and we both got on the telephone and told him," Roosevelt, "how many congressmen we had elected, and it was impressive. A hell of a lot of congressmen. And it impressed the hell out of Roosevelt. I remember that." Lesser politicians were also impressed. Knowledgeable Democrats in Washington had reluctantly reconciled themselves to the loss of a considerable number of seats in the House. Instead, they had gained 8 while losing 3 in the Senate. "My father expected to lose," Ken Harding recalls. "We were the most surprised people in the world when we didn't lose." Many of the men most directly affected, the Democratic candidates, gave considerable credit for the surprise to Lyndon Johnson. Despite the frenzy of the last days before the election, several candidates had taken time out from their campaigning to write to express appreciation for the help he had given them. "I want to thank you again from the very depths of my heart for the interest you've taken in me. Because of the confidence which you have manifested and the effort you have put forth," Arthur Mitchell wrote. Said Nan Honeyman, "As darling as I think it was of you, I still was a bit perturbed over your taking all the trouble to enlist the interest of the state of Texas in my welfare. Really, darling, that was too good of you and of them. How can I thank you? If I am elected, I shall really owe the victory to your efforts. After the election, similar letters were received at the Muncie building from scores of men who remembered the yellow rectangles from Western Union that had arrived with the information or the money they needed, and who wanted to thank the man who had sent them. "Before you came to my rescue, I was really getting discouraged," John Key of West Virginia wrote. Thanking Johnson for the money he sent, John F. Hunter of Ohio wrote, "We were able to put on some 30 short radio programs in the last 2 days." Lansdale G. Sasser of Maryland said, "I used it among our colored vote very effectively, both for the president and myself. Certainly, I never had such grand cooperation from the Congressional Committee before," wrote Draper Allen of Michigan. "This is the first time I've ever received any financial assistance from Washington, and I assure you I deeply appreciate it." And some of the gratitude was expressed in a form that must have been particularly pleasing to a man looking down a long road. "Congratulations on your fine and successful work in the campaign," wrote Pat Morrison of South Dakota. "We look forward to the date, not too far distant, when our delegation will be able to be of aid and assistance to you." Says Walter Jenkins, "There was a lot of gratitude among his colleagues for what he had done. I saw it in the phone calls and the letters, and the feeling of respect. It built him up from being just, he was barely a first-term congressman, to probably the most..." Here Jenkins pauses and searches for the right word, and finally says, "He was the hero." The same feeling was expressed by observers less impressionable than Jenkins, wrote Drew Pearson and Robert S. Allen in their Washington Merry-Go-Round column. "To the boys on the Democratic side of the House of Representatives, many of them still nervously mopping their brows over narrow escapes, the hero of the hair-raising campaign was no big-shot party figure. The big names got all the publicity, but in the House all the praise is for a youngster whose name was scarcely mentioned. But he left his mark on the battle, as GOP campaign managers will ruefully attest. Their nemesis and the Democrats' unknown hero was Lyndon Baines Johnson, a rangy 32-year-old, black-haired, handsome Texan, who has been in Congress only 3 years, but who has political magic at his fingertips and a way with him that is irresistible in action. How Johnson took over the Democratic congressional campaign, when it looked as if the party was sure to lose the House, and without fanfare turned a rout into a cocky triumph, is one of the untold epics of the election." Gratitude is an emotion as ephemeral in Washington as elsewhere, but Lyndon Johnson obtained from his work with the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee a reward more lasting. During those 3 weeks in the Muncie building, his secretaries had compiled lists of congressmen who had asked for money and the amounts for which they had asked, and then the lists had been placed before Lyndon Johnson for decisions. If Sam Rayburn or John McCormick requested a specific amount of money for a specific congressman, Johnson would honor the request, but these requests were relatively infrequent, and except in those few cases, the decision as to which congressman got money and how much he got would be Lyndon Johnson's decision. His alone. "Okay," he wrote next to some requests. "None," he wrote next to others. $1,000 would be a lifesaver. None. "An additional 300 will, I'm sure, get results." None. Out. The words and numbers he wrote on those lists were a symbol of a power he now possessed over the careers of his colleagues. The power was a limited one. It was the power of the purse, and the purse was not a large one, small though it might be in comparison to the purse which financed a presidential campaign, however. It was not small to most of the men whose campaigns it was financing. It was substantial in terms both of their needs and of their expectations. They needed its contents, needed it badly. What Lyndon Johnson wrote beside their names had played a role, a small but a definite role, in determining their fates. Returning to Washington after the election, congressmen compared notes on their campaigns, and in these discussions, the name of Lyndon Johnson kept coming up. When someone mentioned it to a freshman congressman, Augustine B. Kelly of Pennsylvania, Kelly said, "Oh, Lyndon Johnson, he really had a lot to do with me getting elected." He sent money up to my campaign. He'd call up from Washington to see how we were getting along and what we needed. Gus, what do you need? And he sent me money and kept up with my campaign. Listening to his colleagues talk, a congressman who had received campaign funds from Johnson, funds on a scale unprecedented for a central Democratic congressional financing source, would realize that Johnson had contributed funds on a similar scale to scores of congressmen. Through cloakrooms and speakers' lobby, spread a realization that, in some way most of them did not understand, this young, junior, rather unpopular congressman, a scant 3 years on the Hill, had become a source, an important source, of campaign funds. For some of these funds, the money from Texas, he had, moreover, become the sole source. The telegrams candidates had received from Johnson announcing that funds were on the way had said they had been contributed by my good Democratic friends in Texas, by his friends. The recipients did not know who those friends were, and even were they to find out, they could hardly ask these Texans with whom they were not even acquainted to contribute to their campaigns. Their only access to this new and apparently substantial source of money was through Lyndon Johnson. He controlled it. The money they needed could be obtained only through him. They were going to need money again in 1942, of course, in less than 2 years. In 1942, and in succeeding years. Whether or not they liked Lyndon Johnson, they were going to need him. Not merely gratitude, but an emotion perhaps somewhat stronger and more enduring. Self-interest dictated that they be on good terms with him. This realization, the reality behind it, abruptly altered Johnson's status on Capitol Hill. When Congress had left Washington in October, he had been just one congressman among many. Within a short time after Congress returned in January, the word was out that he was a man to see, a man to cultivate. Harold E. Cole of Boston, a friend of John McCormick, had lost a close race and was planning to run again. He hadn't learned until late in the campaign of Johnson's role in campaign funding, and he didn't want to make the same mistake again. He wrote Johnson asking if he could come to Washington and drop in and see him. Working closely with Johnson, Jim Rowe had understood what he was trying to accomplish with the money from Texas. He was really trying to build a power base as a new congressman, he says. And he succeeded. Ray Roberts, a Rayburn aide, says that Johnson had made lots of enemies in Congress. He was brash, he was eager, and he wanted people to move out of the way. The thing that really gave him his power was becoming chairman of the Congressional Campaign Committee. There were some 30 or 40 people, after the 1940 election, that figured they owed their seat in the House to Lyndon Johnson. Whenever he called on them, he could count on this group being for whatever he wanted. Roberts' remark is an exaggeration. Lyndon Johnson controlled no congressman that completely. As an analysis of the alteration in Johnson's status, however, Roberts' remark was in some respects an understatement. For it was not only junior congressmen with no influence whom Johnson had helped. During the campaign, John McCormick had been asking Lyndon Johnson for funds for his Massachusetts delegation and for old friends from other states, and for credit for himself from those other congressmen for obtaining them. And Johnson had given the majority leader what he asked for. Now the majority leader owed him something. The situation was duplicated with other members of the House hierarchy. The William H. Sutphin of New Jersey, who had pleaded with him for funds and who had received in return $1,500, was the assistant majority leader. Andrew J. May of Kentucky, "I hope you can do something for me and I will owe you an undying debt of gratitude," was chairman of the Military Affairs Committee. Normally, young congressmen were suppliants to the majority leader or the assistant whip or committee chairman for favors. In the case of this young congressman, the situation had been reversed. The extent of the reversal was dramatized the first time the House Naval Affairs Committee met following the election. Normally, in a committee, seniority was the determining factor. When the Democrats moved into their seats this time, Johnson was still 5 seats away from the chairmanship. But 3 of the 5 men ahead of him in seniority owed him favors because of his contributions to their campaigns. He had been not only dealing with the most senior members of his party in the House, but dealing with them from a position of independent strength. When he asked Sam Rayburn and John McCormick to come to a luncheon meeting, they came. nor during the campaign had he dealt only with congressmen. When he had asked labor leaders in New York to intervene in a strike in the state of Washington, he had been playing a national political role. And his work with powerful political figures across the country had not consisted merely of liaison work. There had been a Chicago line. Precisely what it was, how Johnson operated through it, or how much he gave through it cannot be determined. But it had a connection with Chicago boss Ed Kelly. By the end of the campaign, he had become acquainted with, had worked with, had funneled money through some of the most powerful men in America. There was a New York connection, too. At first, the connection had been Tommy Corcoran. It was he who raised cash from New York Garment Center leaders such as Hillman or Lubin or Dubinsky. But by the end of the campaign, Johnson was personally acquainted with them. Several of them, in fact, were to become strong Johnson allies and generous Johnson financial backers. Men such as Kelly and Lubin were not without influence on congressmen. After the 1940 campaign, Johnson was in a position to ask them to use that influence. A congressman who would not respond to a Johnson request might receive a telephone call from his own hometown. He even had a potential ally, if a low-level one, on the staff of the Democratic National Committee. Paul Aiken wrote to Johnson, "One of your chief boosters, Swagger Shirley, has been spending a lot of time with me in the last few days." And as a result, Aiken would look Johnson up on his next trip to Washington. All these things combined to radically alter Johnson's status. The alteration was apparent at Georgetown dinner parties, where he dozed off at tables less frequently. His need to be the center of attention at parties had been thwarted by the degree to which in Washington attention was a function of power. But now, as Dale Miller puts it, because of his political power, he was more often the center of attention. The alteration was apparent in the House cloakrooms and dining room, where, before the 1940 campaign, some fellow representatives would snub Johnson, greeting other colleagues while ignoring him because, as one says, they wouldn't put up with him. He still acted the same way in the House dining room, strolling through it, nodding to left and right as if he were a visiting celebrity, head huddling, talking loudly. But his colleagues put up with him now. Symbolically, the shrinking away was much less evident. The fellow congressman whose lapel he grasped, while staring into his eyes and talking nose to nose, was often a colleague who had appealed to him for help, and who had received that help. A colleague, moreover, who not only had needed him once, but who would need him again. A congressman who was thinking about his next campaign didn't resent Lyndon Johnson's arm around his shoulders. He was all too happy to have it there. Before 1940, Johnson had never been shy about asking for favors, irritating colleagues by his insistence when he had no favors to do them in return. He was in position now to return favors in a big way. And if other representatives still felt irritated, they no longer allowed the irritation to show. Says one, "A lot of guys still didn't like him, but unlike before the 1940 campaign, you tolerated his idiosyncrasies, because you knew this guy was going somewhere. You knew, I don't think most of us knew how he had done it, but we knew he had done it, that he had already started going somewhere. A lot of guys still didn't like him, but they knew they might need him someday. Now he was a guy you couldn't deny anymore." The new power he possessed did not derive from Roosevelt's friendship or from Rayburn's. It did not derive from seniority in the House, nor even, despite the relationship that power in a democracy bears to the votes of the electorate, to his seat in it. His power was simply the power of money. To a considerable extent, the money was Herman Brown's. A single corporation, Brown and Root, may have given Democratic congressional candidates more money than they received from the Democratic National Committee. Lyndon Johnson had been attempting to, as Roe puts it, build a power base. He had succeeded. His power base wasn't his congressional district, it was Herman Brown's bank account. Although he was young, he had been seeking national power for years. Now the power of money had given him some. Simultaneously, it had given a new kind of power to Texas, through him. This was a significant aspect of his work in the 1940 campaign. Texas had had power in Washington for 9 years, since Dick Clayburgh's victory had given the Democrats control of the House in November 1931, and John Garner had taken the Speaker's chair. But that power had been somewhat personal, and therefore in constant danger of vanishing. Much of it had been embodied in and exercised through Garner, leader of the Lone Star State's delegation, and the key protector of the state's interests in Washington, not only because of his position, but because of the power of his personality. The ephemeral nature of power based on individuals was vividly demonstrated by the fact that Cactus Jack was, abruptly, no longer even going to be present in Washington. Sam Rayburn's ascension to the speakership and Texas's continuing hold on key committee chairmanships in both House and Senate meant that Texas still had power in the Capitol, but great as this power was, it could disappear in a day, Election Day. Because of Texas's predilection for keeping its congressmen in office indefinitely, there was little fear that they themselves would lose some November, but their power rested on an overall Democratic majority in the House and Senate that depended on less reliable states. A Democratic loss would cost them their chairmanships and their power, and a Republican victory was not the only way in which Texas could lose power. A chairmanship could be lost through death, as Buchanan's death had cost Texas the key appropriations post. And the key Texas chairmanships in the House were held by elderly men. In the world of the pork barrel and the log roll, Texas had a commanding position because of Joseph Jefferson Mansfield. Let that elderly wheelchair-bound man die, and Texas's power over public works would vanish in the instant of his death. A chairmanship could be lost through individual ambitions. Arrangements had, in fact, already been finalized for the Agriculture Committee's Marvin Jones to resign his House seat for a federal judgeship immediately after the election. In 1932, Texas had held not only the speakership, but five key House chairmanships. Jones's departure would reduce the number to three. Moreover, because in a legislative body, personal relationships are so important, the effects of increased Republican strength would be for some period of years irreparable. A Republican victory would sweep out of office congressmen with whom Texas had long and close alliances. The Democrats might return to a majority, but they might be different Democrats. The power of money was less ephemeral than power based on elections or individuals. It could last as long as the money lasted, exerting its effect not only on an incumbent, but on his successors. And there was enough oil in Texas so that it would last, in political terms, a long time. Lyndon Johnson had become the conduit for the oil men's money. To the extent that he could remain the conduit, his power would endure. And there was a lot more Texas money available than had been apparent in the 1941 campaign. Lyndon Johnson's base had been Herman Brown's money, but he had expanded that base by adding to Herman's cash, Sid Richardson's and Clint Murchison's. The extent of their wealth made his power base infinitely expandable. It could become a factor in campaigns other than those for members of the House of Representatives. It could exert more influence. To the extent that he remained in charge of its distribution, he could exert more influence. In terms of power in Washington, his power was still quite small. But if the amount of money at his command grew larger, his power might grow with it. If journalists did not generally understand the reason for Johnson's new status, some of them were aware of it, wrote Alex Lewis, a correspondent for a Texas newspaper chain. When the United States Congress convenes for a new session in January, the familiar face of John Nance Garner will be missing for the first time in more than a third of a century. After a brilliant career as Congressman, Speaker of the House, and Vice President, the bushy-browed Westerner who rose to higher official position than any other Texan in history will be absent. Yet one of the eternal charms of politics is that as the old political oaks fall before the axe of retirement or death, sturdy new ones are rising in the forest to take their place. To many a Washington and Austin observer this winter, it seems that one of the sturdiest saplings in the forest, a young one which may grow into a mighty pillar of strength not only for Texas but for the American nation, is 32-year-old Congressman Lyndon B. Johnson of Johnson City. A member of Congress for the past 3 years, tall, dark-haired, handsome Lyndon Johnson, already has won an enviable position in Democratic circles and national affairs. A symbolic scene had dramatized Lewis's analysis. John Garner's last cabinet meeting, the end of his active political life in Washington, had been held on October 4th, and at its conclusion, the grizzled vice president came up to the president and said, "Well, goodbye, boss." He clapped the president on the shoulder with one hand and gripped him with the other, appearing, in Ickes's description, to be a very pleasant fellow indeed, saying farewell to a man to whom he was deeply attached. Then he turned and walked out of the room. Icus was a witness to the farewell because he had been waiting after cabinet to have a word with the president. The word was on behalf of Lyndon Johnson. At the time, Johnson had not yet been given a role in the national congressional campaign, and he had asked Icus to urge Roosevelt to give him one. Roosevelt had already decided to do so, and he told Icus this. In the very moment in which the old Texan was making his exit from the national political scene, therefore, arrangements were being made for the entrance onto the national stage of a younger representative of the great province in the Southwest. Lyndon Johnson's work with Democratic congressional candidates had in effect added a new factor to the equation of American politics. The concept of financing congressional races across the country from a single central source was not new, but the Democrats had seldom, if ever, implemented the concept on the necessary scale or with the necessary energy. "No one before had ever worked at it," James Rose says. "Johnson worked at it like hell. People running for Congress in those days never had much money. It had been that way for years. But Lyndon decided to do something about it. He got in with both feet, the way he did everything, and he raised a hell of a lot of money." In effect, says Robert S. Allen, "he was being a one-man national committee for congressmen." An apt analogy, although he was ostensibly assisting the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, his connection with that body consisted almost entirely of the checks he brought to it. Otherwise, working out of his own office and with his own staff, he operated entirely on his own. The scale of money he raised for congressional races was unusually large for his party. His involvement in other aspects of congressional races, liaison with the White House and through the White House with other government departments, furnishing candidates with information, was unprecedentedly active. Almost incredibly, although confirmed by the surviving congressmen of that era, so was the coordination and financing of speakers' tours that he undertook. As to the liaison between candidates and White House on approval of public works and other governmental projects, this had not been undertaken on a similar scale even by the better organized Republicans, possibly because under Republican presidents in the pre-New Deal era, the federal government had not sponsored public works projects on the broad-scale basis that existed in 1940. Nor had the liaison in reverse that he undertook, the use of congressmen as sources of information, the rapid collecting of their information, its collating and dispatch to the White House. By the 1980s, when Democratic and Republican congressional committees would be large-scale operations that furnished services and money to candidates, it would be difficult to imagine an era in which most congressmen were left to fight their campaigns without significant help from their national party. But before Lyndon Johnson, that was certainly in the case of the Democrats, and to some extent in the case of Republicans, largely the practice. Discussing what Lyndon Johnson did in the campaign of 1940, James Rowe says flatly, "Nobody had ever done this before." The hallmark of Johnson's career had been a lack of any consistent ideology or principle, in fact, of any moral foundation whatsoever, a willingness to march with any ally who would help his personal advancement. His work with the Congressional Campaign Committee brought this into sharper focus. Because Democratic congressional candidates in the one-party South had no opposition in the November elections, he was providing money only to Democrats in the North, who were primarily liberals. But the money came from men who were not liberals. Some of them, in fact, were arch-conservatives. Among the Texas Friends who had provided funds for Lyndon Johnson to distribute were men who would be bankrollers in 1944 of the Texas Regulars, Texans who bolted the party rather than support Roosevelt. He was helping New Dealers with the money of men who hated the New Deal. In dealing with these men, Johnson did not make the slightest effort to paper over this conflict in his fundraising efforts, nor was it necessary for him to do so. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.